Good afternoon, everyone. Call the committee to order. Okay, we've clearly got optics. We've seven. We need eight, right? For eight? Anybody want to pretend? Any former members in the audience? No, not yet.
Highest bidder.
There we go.
I mean, if I can have a strip joint, I can have highest bid too.
Ooh.
Okay, we are not able to approve the minutes at this time. It's just, Representative Erickson, it's just a whole different side of you. Eight. There we go. Representative Erickson, would you please move?
Already here.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Excellent. Well, I would have, if I'd seen the pack, I would have.
Mr. Chair, I will move approval of the minutes.
Thank you very much.
January 15th.
Very good. All those in favor of the motion to approve the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Noes? Motion approved. Before we move on to continuing the committee overview where we left off yesterday, and I appreciate the staff being in position to do that, Representative Torkelson, you wanted to raise an issue as GOP lead.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't understand Morse code, but whoever's trying to communicate with us.
Neither does anyone else anymore, Representative Torkelson.
I apologize for missing part of the meeting yesterday. I did have a conflict, but you and I talked earlier today of discussing some of the issues around the rules as they've been, rules and procedures as they've been presented to the committee. And my biggest concern is the rule regarding germaneness. And I just wanted to make sure that we had a clear understanding between you and I and between the rest of the committee members as to how this germaneness rule might apply. And you assured me in our private meeting that it was not the intention of this rule to avoid any votes in this committee. Is that correct, Mr. Chair?
Representative Torkelson, yes, that is. You and I had talked before yesterday's committee meeting over a draft of the rule, more procedures than rules, but the rules and procedures for the committee. At that time, you'd urged a 24-hour rule on amendments. I heard from staff that that put them sometimes in a difficult position. I didn't think that was appropriate. I thought the difficult position should be between members, not between members and staff, and that I didn't want a log jam or to blunt debate here in the committee. But that I did expect the debate and amendments to be about property taxes. And I shared with you some stories from my service on the full committee when people attempted to do game and fish provisions in the tax committee. I don't know much about trout or trout seasons, and I don't think that this committee should get into that. I think we should. I want this committee's jurisdiction to be respected by other committee chairs and other committees, and I think the way we, part of the way we do that is by respecting other committees' jurisdiction as well.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, for those comments. Just a little more clarification along those lines, and assuming that, you know, that the definition of germaneness would really include any tax issues or property tax issues. That would come, that would be appropriate to bring in as an amendment.
Representative Torkelson, you know, my memory from Mason's is that you look at the title of the bill, you look at the statutory citation, and there's a third measure that I always go to on the House floor, and it's not coming to me right now. The amendment can't expand the title. It has to be to a provision in statute that's found in the bill, and anybody else want to help me here, the third provision? Representative Garofalo, come on, you're wicked on this stuff.
One issue.
Okay. That's not ringing bells, but I'll take it for right now. You know, that's what I'm looking for, is that if we've got a bill before us on some aspect of property taxes and you or, you know, any of your members, any of my members, wish to bring forward an amendment related to that, that's just fine. But we avoid distractions and debates that aren't part of what we're the work in front of us.
And it's my concern, and I think the concern of others, that we not mimic the House floor identically here in committee. That's not been the practice in the past. but that certainly understanding that we want to stick to the topic is appropriate.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, House rules and Masons do apply to committee work. So I don't think we're doing anything different here than what's maybe unstated but expected in other committees.
Well, Mr. Chair, then.
Representative Runbeck.
You know, I don't know how many amendments we went through, you know, in the last 2 years, but, you know, you don't even anticipate that anyone on this committee is going to be dealing with anything other than things that are related. I mean, I just, you know, it didn't happen. I doubt if it would happen from our side, you know, in the reverse situation. So that seems hardly worth needing mention. But if you're going to go to statutes, I don't know that we need to know which statutes then that mm-hmm. you know we can be covered under.
Well, Representative Runbeck, maybe it's like wearing a seatbelt. Most days I don't need it.
Mr. Chair, this is an idea, but just to wrap the conversation up here, we can move on to the presentation. I suspect that you've been
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, you've been around here long enough to know that when an amendment is offered, that it's just debating the substance of the amendment and dispensing with it is a lot easier than ruling an amendment is not germane. So I'm going to say that when a chair tries to rule an amendment that is related to property taxes is not germane, not that you would ever do that, but when a chair tries to argue germaneness, they end up elongating the conversation by about tenfold. That's been my experience. I think you've been around long enough, and I think that we have a pretty good understanding that you're going to be a fair chair and you're not going to expand the committee's ruling to say that a certain type of property tax can't be applied to another type of property tax aid or something. So I think we're in understanding. We can probably move on to the presentation.
Reverend Scroffler, are we in agreement that we don't deal with the trout season then in this committee?
Yeah, I don't think we need to put that in the rules, though.
We can fine. Yeah. Well, we don't need to hopefully get a rule that's that specific. Thank you, Representative Garofalo. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate you taking a little extra time on this. Sorry about that, but just wanted some clarification.
Glad to do it. Thank you for raising the issues and the concerns, Representative Torkelson. Good afternoon.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Hines. Where did we leave off
yesterday?
It was a bit of a cliffhanger, as I recall.
Slide 34.
Slide 34, very good.
Slide 34, very good. And in the longer document, the 8.5 by 11 version, that's page 35, 36. We just have a brief discussion of property the incidence of the property tax. And for those of you in the full committee today, you got a little bit of a background on the tax incidence analysis here, that the Department of Revenue every 2 years does a thorough study of the tax system and tries to determine the incidence of each of the major taxes relative to income. And we've just taken a couple of slides of that on property taxes and tried to give you just a taste of what the incidence is of the property tax as according to the tax incidence study. And this data is a little bit old. This is from 2008 because this was the study that came out in 2011. And there will be a new one coming out in just a couple months here, and that will presumably update the data by 2 years, but that's a reason why the data is a little old here. And what this is showing is that the property tax is a regressive tax, as most people, I think, do acknowledge or are aware. If you look at the bars, the lowest quintile, just on the gross tax, the tax based on the value of the property, with the credits and the class rate structure, et cetera. See, the lowest quintile pays an effective rate of about 8.2%, and it then drops down to 2.6% in the highest quintile. But then if you consider the effects of the property tax refund, you'll see that that's the gray bar, the shorter gray bars, and in that one, that does reduce the regressivity significantly, although it still would qualify as a regressive tax, but the first quintile drops down to about 5.9% of income. The middle three quintiles are all right around the same level at about 3.7, and then the fifth quintile 2.6. So it does show that the PTR does have, I think, what is the desired effect of really greatly reducing the regressivity of the property tax system.
Mr. Hines, since we have a number of committee members who have not served either on the division or the full committee in the past, I'm hearing Dr. Wilson's voice in my head, reminding us that that first quintile statistically is problematic. And I wonder if you could just walk through some of those concerns with committee members so they have a better understanding.
Very, very good memory, Mr. Chair. Yes, and Dr. Wilson would be the one who would be giving you this description more accurately than I. The incidence report, as the Department of Revenue produced it, is actually in deciles. So you'd actually see 10 bars. We've consolidated them for the to shorten it up for this presentation. In particular, we talk about that lowest decile. So here it's affecting the lowest quintile as being problematic because it's basically showing incomes that are quite low and sometimes negative. And what we find from that is that it's, while you tend to think it's people with very low income, in fact that population also has people that we would generally think of as high income, but because of the unevenness of their income flow, particularly people with a lot of investments, et cetera, that have a bad year or whatever, they can show a negative income even for a year. And so that lowest quintile or decile for sure and affecting the lowest quintile here is misleading. And that is another reason why we did the quintiles, is to allow us to sort of get a little bit away from that one, but it's still affecting that first one. So
additionally, right. Thank you. Additionally, can we talk about measures of regressivity, or would this be an appropriate time for that? Suits index sort of stuff that is always challenging, my understanding, but might be a value in measuring the regressivity of property taxes?
It would be a good time, although I haven't really prepared for that.
Okay.
And so I'm not really up on that right now. I don't know.
Might there be a better time later?
Sure. I think, well, for sure. I mean, when the new one will come out, I believe in March, okay, that would be an excellent time to go through all of the questions you'd have and see the new analysis from the department. And I assume that they're on schedule, on track for March. But so that would be one possibility. We could certainly prepare something in advance of that if you don't want to wait that long.
Okay.
I'd rather spend a little more time going over it than. Okay?
Let's do that.
All right.
Thank you.
Yes. This next slide then shows that the actual amount of property tax paid by the different quintiles. And so even though we said it's a regressive tax, meaning that the lower quintiles pay a disproportionate share of their income vis-a-vis the upper income. The upper income quintiles, you'll see that even with that, certainly most of the tax is paid in those higher income ranges, that the fifth quintile, the highest 20% of household incomes, household incomes, pays 47.6% of the total. So it's good to keep that in mind when you're thinking about the incidence, because it can be misleading to think either measure sort of doesn't show the whole picture without seeing how the tax is actually distributed, but also what it is relative to income. And there's a little more data on page 35 of the longer study that actually shows the numbers of what those quintile ranges are. That fifth quintile is basically 90,000 income and above. Changing gears.
Ms. Trimans, I'm sorry.
Yes.
90,000 per taxpayer household.
Per household, Mr.
Per household.
Chair, yes.
All right. Thank you, sir.
All of the income analysis, all of the tax incidence analysis is done on a household income basis, meaning that multiple people per household are combined, and different measure of income than just than income tax income. It includes a broader definition of income to include other sources of income as well.
Thank you.
Then the next slide, 36, we bring in a small discussion about the taconite tax, particularly the taconite production tax. And as most of you who've been around a while are realized, taconite operations are exempt from regular in-lieu property taxes. So that's the mines and the plants that the taconite is processed do not pay property taxes. Instead, the industry pays a production tax based on the amount of tonnage produced, and then the money is distributed throughout the range according to a number of formulas. In 2012, the production tax generated $80 million of revenue. The tax rate is $2.40 per ton. They base it on a three-year average production. It as even with that, it fluctuates some fairly much from year to year, but the three-year averaging was done to sort of minimize some of that fluctuation. But because the industry is relatively subject to the general trends of the economy, that production tax revenues can vary quite a bit from year to year. The distributions from that fund are quite complex formulas that refer back to, in trying to read through them, you get to places that refer to the amount of tonnage produced in 1941 and things like that that are always a little bit of an impediment to trying to research things up there too well. The table on the bottom of page 37 of the report shows the distribution by type of jurisdiction. So counties, cities, school districts all get sort of a share of it. Then there's a chunk that goes to something called the Taconite Homestead Credit. So each homestead in the Taconite production tax area does receive a homestead credit that's different than anyone else in the state gets, or that is not available to people in other parts of the state, that generally is around $300 per home, and that amount's been the same for quite a few years now. In addition, some money is from the Taconite production tax is used to fund the IRRB and some other funds there that are used for economic development purposes and environmental protection purposes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Hines, the Douglas Johnson Economic Protection Trust Fund, does that include the scholarship dollars that are redistributed throughout the state?
Mr. Hines.
I'm going to look to Mr. Michael. And,
no?
No, it does not.
Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Michael reminds me, it's part of the occupation tax. So besides paying a production tax based on tonnage, the mining companies also pay an occupation tax, and that money is strictly goes to the state and is used by the it sort of as a substitute for the corporate income tax and is used for state purposes, and that's apparently where the scholarship is funded.
Thank you.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How does these mining taxes then intersect with the property taxes that are levied to each home? Do they, or property taxpayer, I should say?
Mr. Hines.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, it's an interesting question, one that's not real easy to answer. The first thing to acknowledge is that because the Taconite companies don't pay property taxes, there's not nearly as much tax base up there to fund governmental services as there would be with other kinds of industrial processes. So as a result, these aids are paid to the counties and cities and towns from the Taconite production tax that lowers their need to have property tax levy. And is a way for, in some ways, to look at that as the property tax on the plants and mines. In addition, there's this homestead credit, which further reduces the burden on homesteads a bit. But the main thing is that this is substituting for the property tax revenues that you would expect those properties to pay.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned earlier that these do vary quite a bit from year to year. So does the levy then change from year to year? Which comes first, the chicken or the egg, I guess, is my question.
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, the levies do need to change when they get less money from when the amount of aid they get fluctuates. They will presumably adjust their levies accordingly. There are some protections. Some of the funds in the Taconite Production Fund are saved over from year to year to further smooth out those difficulties, like there those ups and downs. But there certainly is some fluctuation in those levies, more than you'd get in other parts of the state for that reason.
Thank you, Representative Hertas. My apologies.
Thank you, Chair Dabney. Two matters of clarification. It's my understanding, did I hear correctly, that the $80 million of production tax is then paid or distributed exclusively in the northern part of the state or the Iron Range?
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Terhouse, that's correct.
Okay.
Mr. Representative Hertas.
Thank you. The second part of the question is, if it's exempt from the general property, state general property tax levy, which all other businesses throughout the state are subjected to, and that money is distributed throughout the state, then we're not seeing any piece of that $80 million is benefiting taxpayers of Minnesota at large, and it's exclusive to northern Minnesota.
Mr. Hines? Boy, not an Iron Ranger to be seen.
I'm going to see if Mr. Michael can help with it.
Mr. Michael, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, essentially, yes, that's correct. They're not. The production taxes in lieu of property taxes, and of course the state general tax is a relatively recent feature of the state tax landscape. It was enacted in 2001 and first imposed in 2002. And when that was done, there was no provision made that some of the taconite production taxes ought to, you know, should go into the state general fund instead. And that, frankly, at the time, just to provide a little bit of context, was, as Steve was pointing out, the taconite industry tends to be fairly cyclical, tied to the overall ups and downs of the economy, because it's a, you know, the amount of industrial production you have in the nation is what drives whether or not you're going to have a lot of mining or not. And the 2001, 2002, 2003 period was a really down time for the 2002 was a recession year. There were two mines that closed. I think one of them went bankrupt, and actually they didn't even, state was unable to recapture all of the taxes that they owed, and I think all of those things entered into the equation about whether the production tax being in lieu of the property tax somehow would also go into the general fund. And of course, how that state general tax replaced what was called the general ed levy for schools, and how the school formula treated that general ed levy relative to taconite. Also, there were there are always issues about how you sort of mesh together this in lieu tax system with the property tax system that existed with that old general ed levy, which was a sort of a state mandated levy, and how you offset their aids, and that system changed over time. And anyway, it's a sort of a complex and tricky political equation around here, with given all of the circumstances.
Representative Hertas?
Thank you for that clarification. I just want to know how the pie was being divided.
All right. Representative Carlson?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I have a question relative to mining that just happened to think of. You know, we always talk of mining relative to the range because that's where most of it takes place. But there are other mining operations in the state, usually much smaller, but they are mining. Even one area that I can think of in the metropolitan area. Interesting enough, in Maple Grove yet. Just curious, what do they, I know obviously they're not taconite, but do they come under the special laws dealing with mining outside of the taconite issue?
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, I assume you're referring to aggregate mining, gravel.
That would be gravel aggregate.
I know that we also have quarries in the state, but the reality is that gravel operations are not exempt from the property tax, and so they pay property tax. There is authority for local governments, counties mainly, but in some circumstances towns, to impose an aggregate tax that they can do it. Their option that's largely intended to compensate for the external costs that those gravel operations impose on them, like additional wear and tear on roads and so forth. And many counties, that have extensive aggregate operations have opted to do that. Some have not. It's sort of a local choice, and you know, so it varies, but it's not really analogous to the, you know, massive industrial production that goes on in the Iron Range.
I clarified that.
And there's also a separate tax regime that will apply if there's ever, you know, non-ferrous mining that goes on in the state. There's a, as Steve was pointing out, there for the taconite industry, there's a tax, the production tax that's in lieu of the property tax. There's an occupation tax that's in lieu of the corporate tax. In the case of the non-ferrous industry, there's a net proceeds tax that's in lieu of the property tax, and there's a occupation tax that's in lieu of the corporate tax. But of course, we have no experience with that since we've never had that mining. But it may come to pass. It's like Mr. Rubis and I were joking. It seems like it's always, you know, 4 years out. It was that way when I, you know, started here. So.
Okay, well, thank you.
Representative Torkelson.
Yeah, one more quick question along these lines. do the assessors in this part of the state put a value on these properties?
Mr. Michael.
This presentation doesn't get into this, but there's what's called an exempt abstract, where all exempt properties are essentially appraised or valued by assessors. Steve, is it 6 years that they do that? I can't remember whether they do that for mining. If they do, it's probably not very accurate information. In the ancient, I don't, as Steve is saying, and I agree with him, that exempt abstract does not have a value put on it for the value of these mines. Back in the two centuries ago, in the 19th century, the tax, when mining first started in Minnesota, the original tax was a property tax, and of course it's sort of very problematic to put values on these things. And the first fix that was done was they decided to abandon the idea of a property tax around the turn of the 20th century, and go in sort of fits and starts. Took until the 50s really to get where we're at now, but they sort of pretty quickly decided that just was not a workable system. And I think you'd find that most of the mining operations in states that have mines don't use a property tax, because it's so difficult to put a value on what the, you know, what the deposits are worth.
Representative Ferguson.
Thank you.
I have to say, I doubt there are many other people in the state who could provide you with two centuries of tax policy as it applies to mining in Minnesota that succinctly. Thank you, Mr. Michael. Mr. Hines, back to you.
Back to Ms. Dalton.
Ah, very good, Ms. Dalton. Back to you. It's getting to sound like a bad TV newscast.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to talk briefly about a program that currently doesn't exist in the state, but it is one that has been a part of the property tax system off and on since 1972. I get to refer again to the Minnesota Miracle back in 1972 when we enacted the Minnesota Miracle, and we started giving enormous amounts of aid to local governments. Because that money was given to essentially deal with a property tax, a perceived issue of property taxes rising too rapidly, they imposed what are called levy limits. They were in effect through 1992, and then they expired and were essentially replaced with the Truth in Taxation program, which came into effect right around the same time. They have been reenacted several times for short periods, normally to deal with either a lot of changes in property taxes because of reforms or because of aid reductions. The most recently, they were in effect in 2011. They have not been in effect since 2011. Usually, they apply to counties and cities with a population of 2,500 and more. when Mr. Hines was talking earlier about special taxing districts, he talked a little bit about levy authorities. There are actually a number of levy limits in law. Most special taxing districts have a limit on how much they can levy. There are limits on how much individual cities and counties can levy for debt service and things like that. But when people generally talk about levy limits around here, they are talking about these now defunct levy limits that show up in Chapter 275. And that's what I'm talking about. Even though we have these, when we have special, when we have levy limits, first off, they don't limit the just the levy. They're not a limit on the growth in levy. They are a limit on the growth in levy plus 8. So normally when we're looking at that limit, it is levy plus general purpose aids like LGA and county program aid, and they also include the taconite aids in that. So if the taconite aids are going down, traditionally levy limits would have gone up in those communities. And that's to address Representative Torkelson's, how does this interact with the taconite aids? Even when levy limits are in place, there are generally a number of portions of the levy that are not subject to limits. Probably the biggest one is debt. We do not impose limits on debt levies outside the general debt levy limits, and this has to do with how bonding council feels about imposing limits on the authority to pay back bonds. But other special levies that have been common in the past are when federal or state laws require increase in matching funds to receive existing federal or state grants. We normally allow special levies outside of limits for natural disasters, often for increases in mandated public safety and health and human service costs, and recently, pension costs, as there have been required pension cost increases, we've often allowed special levies for that. The most recent has been in the period of 5 years of aid and credit reductions, many of those reductions occurring after certification, leaving cities and counties with budgets that were kind of short. We did allow them to special levy back for those shortfalls caused by unanticipated cuts. Now I'm going to switch to a totally different topic. We are out of property taxes temporarily, although Mr. Michael will take you back into the weeds of property taxes with TIF after I finish this. But one area that this division also deals with is local sales taxes. And I love this. Again, I get to start out with a reference to the Minnesota Miracle. Local sales taxes have been prohibited local governments have been prohibited from instituting new taxes on income or sales since 1972. It was originally part of the LGA statutory language. It was written into that statute. So it was a clear relationship between if the state is going to give lots of aid to cities and counties, they didn't want them imposing these additional taxes. So there was a trade-off there in 1972. Of course, the prohibition is statutory, and you can always override a statutory prohibition. There was one general-purpose local sales tax enacted in 1973, and that was the city of Duluth. It was the only one enacted in that decade, and that's because there was a one-year window when they said, oh, well, maybe we'll let you have them. And Duluth was the only one who actually enacted it during that period. Two were enacted in the 80s, Rochester and Minneapolis. Six were enacted in the 90s. There were actually a number of other ones that were authorized in the 90s. About another dozen of them were authorized in the 90s, although they did not... they were not approved by the voters, so they were never imposed. But what the fact that there was this plethora of them in the 90s led to a 2000 statutory law that basically set up some statutory requirements for how people should go about asking for local levy authority, local sales tax authority. Because, as I said, because of the statutory prohibition, generally you have to have a special law to have a local sales tax. 14 local sales taxes have been enacted and imposed since 2000. These taxes are usually imposed for bricks and mortar projects. There are very few exceptions. Duluth is the only one with a sales tax that is general purpose. Their sales tax money goes right into their general fund and they can spend it for whatever they want. St. Paul has a slightly modified version of that. They actually can spend a portion of theirs for neighborhood and cultural programs, and a part of that can actually be spent for some ongoing operating costs for those cultural programs as well. There are 23 taxes. 25 cities impose a general local sales tax of 0.5%. When I say there's only 23, that's because St. Cloud has actually a St. Cloud area tax that applies to six cities. Duluth and Cook County are allowed to impose a tax of 1%. Hennepin County, as most people know, imposes a tax of 0.15% to fund the Twins ballpark. And there are also some transit taxes which show up in the next. Most recently, six new taxes were authorized in the 2011 session. Three of them have been imposed. I think one or two of them still have open authority. They still can go to the voters at a later date. I think one of them has passed their authorization date. There are transit taxes that were enacted statutorily. The transit tax for the metropolitan area is a 0.25% transit tax. It required a county approval, but not voter approval. It has been imposed in five out of the seven counties in the metropolitan area. The other two counties may impose the transit tax at a future date. All other counties outside of the seven-county metro area and the two counties who have not imposed the transit tax may, but with voter approval, impose a tax up to 0.5% for transportation purposes, but they have to limit it to a specific transportation project, and then it has to expire. The metro transit tax, however, does not expire. There's only one other tax in the state that doesn't at least in law have a expiration date, and that's Duluth. All the other ones have expiration dates, but in reality, not necessarily all of them expire. Minneapolis's half-cent sales tax, which is set to its convention center, dedicated to its convention center, is set to expire when all convention center bonds are paid off. Well, clearly, with that type of expiration date, all you have to do is issue more bonds. And their bonds are for improvements and expansion. So, you know, there isn't a dollar limit to them. Rochester always has an expiration date. Rochester has had its local sales tax extended three or four times. So every time it gets within 1 year of its expiration date, it just comes in with a brand new set of projects and gets authorized. That doesn't mean that there have not been some taxes that have expired. Five of them actually have, and Willmar holds the distinction of being the only city that has actually imposed the tax separately twice and has separately had it expire twice. It just expired December 31st of last year. In addition to the general local sales taxes, there are other local sales tax is allowed on specific things. There is a statutory authority for a 3% lodging tax for tourism purposes. That's imposed in about 100 cities and towns in the state. 95% of that money has to go for tourism promotion. In addition, there are several special law lodging, food and beverage, and amusement taxes in places like Bloomington, St. Cloud, Minneapolis. Those taxes are on, you know, are for very specific purposes. Most of those taxes do not have expiration dates, and they're often used for operating costs of a specific project.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, you mentioned the Convention Center and said that that goes on for repair and betterment kinds of things, and I understand that. Going back to the ballpark, the Hennepin County, when the ballpark bonds are paid for, I've always assumed that that tax expires. Is that true, or does that one continue on as well? Because some of that goes for other projects, ball fields, amateur sports. What happens when the ballpark's paid off?
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, the ballpark tax does expire when the ballpark bonds are paid off. And even though there are some other things that are being paid out of
that's what I always assumed.
Representative Carlson.
When you mentioned the Convention Center, Mr. Chairman, I triggered the thought. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Michael, that looked like a handoff.
I will hopefully do a quick overview of how tax increment financing works that may take us to the end of the hour, and we'll be done with the overview part of the committee meeting a half an hour early. What I'm going to do is talk about just what tax increment is, go over its mechanics, talk about the types of districts, the but-for test, which is considered to be a key part of tax increment, talk about the permitted uses of revenue. And then after I'm done with tax increment, I'll do a contrast between economic development, property tax abatement, and tax increment, which is another tool that local governments have as an alternative to tax increment that's not used very much, but it is another option that, cities and counties have and use. So what is TIF? Basically, tax increment financing is a method by which local governments have the authority to take the increase in property tax that results from a development and use that money not to fund general cost of government that property taxes normally do, but to use it for special purposes to help encourage the development and some other uses. What's unusual about Minnesota in a way is usually people think about TIF as a way to help real estate development occur, and that is a principal thing that is done with tax increment in Minnesota. But the Minnesota law is also flexible that it allows cities, it's mainly cities that use tax increment, to also use it as
I believe in other settings I'd be buying a beer for everybody around the table, but
just so you know, your face right now is slightly more red than your committee your CA's sweater she's got on.
Okay, good, good. Good to know. Thank you. Is it almost salmon colored, Representative Garofalo? Thank you. Representative Garofalo.
Not as funny as the news out of Notre Dame today, but we'll let that one go.
So. Okay, we'll let that one pass and maybe let Representative or Mr. Michaels get back on task here. Sorry about that.
That's fine. So the tax increment law is a little flexible enough that after, if cities have additional increments that they have that they do not need to use for the development that caused the increment to occur, there's also flexibility to use it for other unrelated public improvements, things like roads and so forth. So how does TIF work mechanically? Basically what happens with TIF is the local government, the county auditor, certifies the value, the property tax value of an area of geography at the time the tax increment district is created. And under the law, this is called the original tax capacity. And of course, what you're expecting is somebody's going to build an office building, somebody's going to build a factory, somebody's going to build a warehouse or something like that, and that's going to cause that value to increase. And that's what's going to generate the increment. In Minnesota, and this is a unique feature of the Minnesota tax increment law compared to others, not only do they certify that value, but they also certify the property tax rate that's in effect at that time. And the reason that's done is because if that rate goes up, because, for example, the local governments decided to increase their levies or the local property tax base went down, that increase in the rate will not create tax increment, but it will generate revenues that then flow back to the city, the county, and the school district for general government purposes. So what happens after we've certified this original value and the value goes up because there's housing was built or an office building was built or a factory? That increase in value results in captured value. And the property tax that's paid by that captured value is what generates tax increment. And that tax increment then goes into a dedicated account that the city controls, or the development authority, which is usually a port authority or a housing and redevelopment authority or an economic development authority, controls and can use to help that development, or if they don't need it for that development, then there's an authority for them to use a little bit of that for other purposes like public improvements elsewhere in the city, provided it's within the project area. And it's that authority to use it for other things that causes, it's very rare in Minnesota when tax increment districts to certify early, because the city would like to continue using that money. Now, the thing to keep in mind is these are the taxes that result from the rates that are imposed not only by the city, which is in control of tax increment, but also by the county, the school district, and the other special taxing districts. And that's why the city, if it has its druthers, does not want to decertify the district early, because it's getting the taxes that otherwise, if that district is decertified and the property goes back on the rolls, that then increases the tax base not only of the city but of the county and the school. And as long as the district is operating or is capturing that value, they get all of the taxes, including those that are imposed by the county, the school, and the special taxing district. So that's an important financial slash political dynamic at the local level. The other thing to keep in mind, not only does the value increase because somebody built a new building, improved the property, but inflation can also cause the value to increase. So even if you don't have development, land values can go up, and that generates increment too. And of course, under normal circumstances, all of the taxing districts would share that. So in Minnesota, we've got basically six types of districts. There's a couple of others actually that aren't really ever used. So this is the main one. And these differ in several ways. They differ, as you can see from the screen that's up there, for how long you can capture increment. They also differ as to where you can create them. For example, a redevelopment district, the city has to go out and say, does this meet a blight test, so that we can actually draw a geography and create the district. That's true also of renewal districts, soils districts, and hazardous substance districts. So there are limits on where they can be created, and there are also limits on what they can spend their money on. So for redevelopment districts, for example, they're only supposed to spend their increment on things that are designed to correct the blight that justified creating the district. There's obviously some wiggle room in how all of that goes. But the other thing, of course, as the screen shows, there are limits on how long you can collect increment. So for economic development, it's only 8 years, although they get the first year free, so you have to add one to each of these. So a redevelopment district actually gets 26 years of increment, not 25 years.
Michael, Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted to ask about these caps. I mean, has there been, first of all, I wasn't aware that some of these were so long in duration. I think there's conversation about them being extended. I mean, certain cities do try to extend them. I mean, have we had any luck with making these caps permanent, that sort of thing? Is that
making them real?
An effort? Making them real, yeah.
Mr. Mike.
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck. These caps are hard caps in the statutes, but of course, like Ms. Dalton said, the legislature can always grant exemptions from statutes. You can't exempt things from the Constitution, but you can amend the statutes. And so periodically cities will come in for special legislation and say, this district was supposed to be certified after 25 years, but the problems were bigger than we thought. Increment came in slower because development didn't happen. Please give us an additional 3 years, an additional 5 years. Mm-hmm. And yes, in some instances, y'all have done that and have granted those extensions. In many cases, they've been denied. But yes, that's a dynamic that goes on. Under the old tax increment law, and by the old tax increment law, I'm going really back to my early career here. Since 1979, the current statute was enacted. Before that, there was no limit. It was just as long as it took to complete your activities. When the 79 Act was enacted, it imposed a 30-year limit on those districts. So they got 30 years from 1979, and we just saw those come back online in 2009. Some of those districts, the first one was created by Robbinsdale in 1969. So that district was in place from 1969, could have gone 2009, I think, if you certified early. But some of those districts were 40-year, 35-year districts. But that, ever since the 79 Act, these have been hard statutory duration limits unless the legislature, by special law, grants them an exemption.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you euphoristically kind of talked about wiggle room on some of these. Could you define wiggle room? And is there any is there any reporting on what? I mean, are they required? Whoever has the tax increment finance district, are they required to report what they might spend the money on otherwise?
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, yes, they, by wiggle room, I just want to define that term for you. there are percentage limits on how much increment you can spend outside of the area of the district and within the broader project area, and it's that outside of the district that allows them to draw a big project area and then make improvements to, say, roads in the city or sewer and water or that, or for other unrelated activities. I mean, not unrelated to the project area, but right. So that's what I meant when I referred to wiggle room. There's also, yeah, anybody who's worked in the tax increment law for any period of time will quickly realize there are lots of ambiguous provisions that also allow some wiggling. With regard to reporting, they are required to annually report to the Office of the State Auditor, which also is authorized to and does audit them. And so there are annual reports, and you can look at the report for any given district that's filed with the auditor, and the auditor creates an annual report and makes it to the legislature. That reporting did not occur back in the 1970s and 80s. It was required by the legislature in the 90s in response to some unhappiness with some of the activities that were going on locally. The but-for test is an important component of the tax increment law, and of course the but-for test means, again, what we're doing here is we're saying, look, some new property is coming online and we're going to capture the taxes from that property and use it typically to help that development or to build public improvements for that development. And so the overlying taxing districts whose taxes are being used by the city to help this along want some assurance that, gee, that wouldn't be there unless you actually went through this exercise. And so the law has in it what people generally refer to as the but-for test. The development would not have happened but for the city using tax increment to assist it. And so how does that work in the statute? I mean, first of all, it's a municipal finding, so the city makes a finding, and the city makes a determination that when they create the district that the development would not have occurred, and it's based on in the statute the municipality's opinion. So it's not something that's legally easy to enforce because everybody's entitled to their opinion, including cities, I guess. But there are two components. First of all, they have originally the test was this development would not have occurred without tax increment. Well, anybody who's got a little creativity can realize that, hey, you know, we would have built a 32-story office building. If you give us tax increment, we'll build a 33-story office building. And so that development would not have occurred, and so therefore we can use tax increment. And real-life examples, there is one city which shall remain unnamed that for a long time had a rule that you could not build a commercial building with a loading dock that you could see from the city street. And so they could use tax increment as a way to help the developers make sure that those loading docks were not visible from the city street. I mean, that's back in my early years here. But anyway, so that's the way the but-for test was originally. In the 1980s, as a way to sort of toughen that up, the legislature put in a second component that said not only did they have to find that this development would not happen without the use of tax increment, but that the development that the city thinks would happen without using tax increment would also have been less valuable than the one that they are assisting with tax increment, and the difference is more than what they're projecting to collect in tax increment. So that change that was made in the 1990s put a little bit more teeth, again, this is all what the city opinion is, but it forces the city council, I think, or that was the intent anyway, to do a little more reflection about what would happen at this site without the use of tax increment. So what can you spend tax increment for? The classic thing is you spend it to help acquire the site. I mean, the classic way you use tax increment is you've got dilapidated buildings that you want to replace, redevelop. So the city could come in, use the tax increment to tear down those buildings, prepare the site, and then resell it to the developer. And of course, they can actually give it to the developer. So that's one way that the subsidy of the development can happen. The other things that you classically would use it for are public improvements related to the developments. Maybe you need to improve the streets, put in sewer and water, or build parking facilities for the development. I mean, a ramp might be another possibility. That's a classic use of tax increment. The city may own the ramp, so it's a public improvement, but it really benefits the private developer. Generally, it's not used, tax increment in Minnesota is not used to build private buildings. It's usually done for site acquisition and public improvements. In the housing instance, it can be used and frequently is used to actually help build private improvements. And there, getting back to Representative Mahoney's talk about wiggle room, there are ways to wiggle around and get increment to be used for private improvements as well. So what can't you use tax increment by? Well, the general rule is if it doesn't explicitly allow it in the Tax Increment Act, you can't use it. And the thing that's complicated about it as a statutory matter is the Tax Increment Act sort of refers back to the Development Authority Acts for all of this stuff. So you got to go back to the EDA law or to the HRA law and say, what can an EDA spend money on? But the Tax Increment Act explicitly says you cannot use it to build government buildings. And you can understand this was written in by the legislature in 1982 because they discovered that, again, come back to the financial dynamic with tax increment. We're talking about the taxes that are paid not only by the city's levy, but by the county and the school. So a couple of, you know, creative cities said, hey, this would be a great way to build City Hall or to build a fire station, because the taxes on this new building that's been built that are levied by the county and the school also will help pay for this. So the legislature came in 1982 and said, no, you cannot use the tax increment to build a general purpose municipal building. And most, as I said before, it's not generally used for private buildings in Minnesota. So how extensively has tax increment been used in Minnesota? One way to measure this is how much of the tax base is captured by tax increment. Again, the Maine Tax Increment Act that really made it clear how to use tax increment passed in 1979, so this graph goes back to 1980. The heyday of tax increment use in Minnesota was in the occurred in the 1980s. This is when the law was fairly wide open. There was a legislative auditor's study that was requested by the legislature in 1986 and 1988, and in 1990, the legislature looked at and imposed restrictions. And if you look at this graph, you can see how those restrictions had an effect, because if you look, you can see that up until 1980, we were on a steep upward slope. In 1990 was when the legislature put the restrictions on tax increment. Then things began to plateau off, because all of these restrictions are generally applied to new districts, not to existing districts. So those districts that were created in the 1980s could keep going along with the old rules, but it became more difficult to create new districts. So you see the plateau effect. Once those districts started that were created under the looser rules in the 1980s began to decertify, which they are doing now, started in the late 90s and are now, you can see the effect on the graph where it tails off to the right side. This shows the amount of increment revenues, which have been, again, you see the same pattern where they grew in the 1980s and plateaued. They dip. There's a dip between 1997 and 2002 because of the 2001 property tax change, which, as Representative Torkelson noted before, that was the point at which the state general tax was enacted. And one of the key things with regard to the tax increment dynamic was that that law said that tax cannot be captured by tax increment, whereas the tax that it replaced, the general ed levy, was captured by tax increment. And that general ed levy was one of the real reasons why cities and other local governments that had the authority loved to use tax increment, because the state sort of held school districts harmless from the effect of tax increment on the general ed levy. And so taking that authority away, you can see the dip there. Now, increments have recovered a bit, but they're still a little bit lower than they were in the 90s. This graph shows the types of districts by percentage. And you can see redevelopment districts are about half of the districts. Housing districts are about 30%. Economic development districts, 17%. And then the rest are pretty minor. This graph shows the amount of outstanding tax increment debt. It, like tax increment revenues, is declining. There's another factor that's involved here, and that's that cities have largely gone wisely to having developers finance these improvements rather than issuing their own debt. So they're done as what are called pay-as-you-go districts, where the developer upfronts the city money rather than having the city issue its own bonds and be at risk if the increments don't materialize as expected. And so that also is part of the reason why these bars decline to the right. Like I said, in the late 80s and 1990s, the legislature imposed a bunch of restrictions on TIF that have curtailed its use. Some of these are expressed as rule years, and this slide shows them. There's a four-year rule that came on early in 1982 that basically says if a city puts a parcel into a tax increment district and nothing happens, and the theory back then, that was a high inflation time, that they were doing that just to capture the increment that's paid by the growth in value. The four-year rule says that parcel drops out. In our current low inflation environment, this is not a big deal. It was back in the 80s, it's not now. As I was mentioning before, there are restrictions on pooling that limits how much you can take from the place where you captured the increment that generated and spend it elsewhere in the city. And generally that rule is you can never spend more than 25% of the increment outside of the area of the district. And you will see that a number of requests for special law exemptions focus on that restriction. They want more flexibility to spend increment elsewhere. There's a five-year time limit that says you've got 5 years after you certify the district to complete your activities, and then starting in the sixth year, all you're supposed to do is pay off what you
that you'll also see many requests for exemptions from that rule by cities for individual districts. As I indicated, there's this other law that allows cities to grant property tax abatements, and these can be used for all the same purposes that TIF can be used for, and a lot more. It's much more wide open. There's a maximum duration limit on abatements of 10 years, but if only one governmental unit approves it, then you can extend that to 15 years. This slide shows the kind of things that you can use property tax abatement for, increasing the tax base, providing jobs, public infrastructure, and so forth. The key thing that's different from abatement and tax increment gets back to this dimension of the overlying taxing districts. With tax increment, the city is capturing the taxes that are paid by all, that are levied by all units of government. With abatement, each unit of government, the city, the county, and the school, has to approve that their tax can be abated. And so that's the reason why abatement is not as generous and why it's very little used. It's probably, guessing, 1/50th or somewhere 1/25th the use of abatement compared with tax increment. I think that despite the greater flexibility to spend the revenues, you have to get approval from each of the units of government, and that's much more difficult. If you want to get down to this much more, there isn't much in this document, but on our website there's a thing that's called the TIF primer. There's probably 50 pages of information there that you can go and click through to what, if you're interested in some aspect of it. The state auditor's website also has all of those TIF reports that you can look at, as well as newsletters and guides and so forth. And with that, I ran 5 minutes over what I shot to do.
That's okay. Thank you, Mr. Michael.
That was Mahoney's wiggle.
Ms. Schill, do you have things you want to start today, or how do you wish to proceed? Well, I think we've got 10 minutes then. And do you have a new handout for members, Ms. Schill?
I do.
If the page could assist, please. Pages. Thank you. Ms. Schill, thank you.
Mr.
Welcome to
Chair
the committee.
And members, Kathy Schill, House Fiscal. I'm here to talk about some of the basic fiscal tools that we will use in this committee. You'll need three documents, two of which is in your folder, and then you have a new one being distributed. The first one is entitled Revenue Estimates. The second one is entitled Catalog of Budget Activities. And the third is the document being distributed. It is a overview, as you can see on the screen. And the one that's in your packet is longer than the one that I'm giving to you right now. So I was looking to streamline this as much as possible. First, I will go over revenue estimates. And actually, this document talks about revenue estimates, fiscal notes, local impact statements, and then a reference to legislative tracking sheets. Those of you that are serving on this committee and also on taxes, this is a very similar presentation that we gave yesterday. What I will comment, though, is that for those that are new to the committee, revenue estimates might not be a familiar thing, and so please listen to this portion of the presentation. A revenue estimate provides an analysis of the direct impact on state tax revenues that would result from a proposed change in a state tax law. They are prepared by the Department of Revenue tax research staff. Minnesota Statute Section 270C.11, Subdivision 5, requires that, given reasonable notice, the commissioner prepare an estimate of the effect of state tax revenues, which would result from the passage of a legislative bill establishing, extending, or restricting a tax expenditure.
That's important for you all because part of the jurisdiction of this committee is tax aids and credits. And so any changes, we need to monitor the change as it would impact revenues. Unlike a fiscal note, as is the common tool used in other fiscal committees, a revenue estimate does not estimate the administrative cost to a state agency or to a local government. A revenue estimate provides a summary of the proposed change in law as it relates to current law. It explains the methodology used and the latest forecast information and other data as appropriate. Similar to fiscal notes, revenue estimates are static analyses. They sometimes include behavioral responses, commonly with changes to alcohol and cigarette taxes, but that's not the purview of this committee. And it always assumes 100% tax compliance. To request a revenue estimate for a bill or an amendment, contact fiscal staff, and that could be me or Ms. Templin. What's important, and I've got some, if you're not familiar with revenue estimate, I have some examples here. What's important for this particular committee has to do with Section 270C.991 that is entitled Property Tax System Benchmarks and Critical Indicators. For any property tax change, you will have, in addition to the revenue analysis, an impact analysis on how that change would affect the property tax system. And there are, and this is a list of principles you'll find at the bottom of the very first revenue estimate that I included in your packet. And those principles are to give a better idea, to evaluate how changes in the property tax law will affect the overall property tax system. Now, I remember there was one question yesterday when Mr. Hines was doing his presentation on how many classifications there are in the property tax system. I made some copies, and I unfortunately left them at my desk, where we have the 55 to 57 different kinds of classifications that have evolved since the property tax system was created in 1913. And so the idea of having on this revenue estimate this scale will give you an idea of any proposed changes in law on what the effect on the property tax system is. Not seeing any questions, I will move to fiscal notes. And there is also an example of a fiscal note in your packet. Fiscal notes identify the price tag of proposed legislation focusing on state agency changes in expenditures and revenues that would result from a bill becoming a law. And there is statute that requires fiscal notes to be written when there is an impact on spending or on certain revenues. That's Minnesota Statute 3.98. In practice, though, for this, for the tax committee, for this committee, we use revenue estimates, I would say, about 95% of the time. But there are times that impacts on administration arise. And in the packet of sample documents I gave to you, there is the example of, it's not the Swiecinski bill, it's the Mir bill, where the actual remits came through with no impact on state revenues, but there was a comment contained in the revenue estimate saying there may be additional school district impacts, reductions in penalties, apportioned to schools are required to be made up dollar for dollar by the state. That was an indication to me that we needed more conversation on this. I requested a fiscal note, and the fiscal note came back with an impact of $4.7 million on school districts. So what I'm saying is that we at times need to have two tools of reference to get an accurate accounting or at least an idea of where our fiscal impacts will be. And if there are any questions on which or both that you need, we'll take a look at that, and please, please ask, and I can request a fiscal note for you on any proposed bill that you might have. If you don't know already, fiscal notes are not done by the Department of Revenue. They are done by, managed by the Office of Management and Budget. Indeed. And so it's an entirely different entity, and they have the purview going throughout multiple state agencies if there is a change that is needed in that kind of capacity. Once again, if you need references, they're in the written document given to you. A third tool that we use are local impact notes. And this is in response to a concern in 1997 about state mandates on local governments. Local impact notes estimate local government or school district fiscal impacts of proposed legislation or rule. However, there are a series of exceptions to having a fiscal note, a local impact note done, and they are listed in, once again, in the document given to you here. They are also coordinated by the Minnesota Management and Budget, but actually MMB goes out to local counterparts to get a, to get information on a proposed change in law, and so they are dependent on cooperation and response in a timely way to actually create a local impact note. Therefore, the local impact note may take several weeks to complete, depending on the complexity and the response from local officials. Okay, and the last tool that we have associated with this committee's business is our spreadsheet. And I could go through this presentation. What I think I will do is I will leave it with you. And basically, in the document that you have for revenue estimates, the last three pages contain a the base level forecasted amounts for property tax aids and credits. And what I wanted to present in this presentation, but I am trying to heed the clock, is that this spreadsheet will give you three biennia worth of information: the current biennium that we're working with, the forecasted for fiscal 14 and 15, and then 2 years of planning. When we do budgeting, we do it on a biennial basis, and that is very different than everything that has been presented thus far. Not only do we do it on a fiscal year basis and 2 years at a time, there is a mismatch between how we budget and how the tax system actually works, because the tax system is based on a calendar year. And so a lot of times you'll see numbers associated with impacts on a calendar year basis, and then when it comes through either in a revenue estimate or a fiscal note, it's on a fiscal basis. And so there is a need to heed exactly what you're looking for and read the labels, because something done in a calendar year, we usually have to do it in segments of 6 months and then align it to fiscal year. So your alignment will, that will be done by fiscal staff and Department of Revenue. So just be careful on how you look at that. One more thing about the spreadsheet itself. It is organized by type of assistance. Now, everything done here, we have aids and credits. So the first section you will see refunds. That's tax refunds. So the big items you will see there are homeowner tax refund, renter, property tax refund. The next section is local aids. Those will other be, that's also where there'll be big ticket items like LGA and CPA, local government aid, county program aid. Further on down, there's a section called property tax credits, and that's where we have a number of credits that extend on to the second page. There's a section for taconite aid and relief. Right below that, another section is local pension aids. And why is that in this committee? It's because these are aids that are paid right to local governments. It's mostly for police and fire, but there are other
aides that we pay to in association. There's one here for PERA, Public Employees Retirement Association, and there's a teacher aid here. Once again, they're on our sheet because these are payments directly to local governments. And then on the very last page, you'll see a category for other expenditures, which includes, at least on this base level spreadsheet, PILT, which is a payment in lieu of taxes for natural resources lands. I wanted to give you a heads up on this, as the committee accounts were assigned in this particular biennium. This committee will not have the purview of using PILT. That has been transferred to the Natural Resources Committee. It was that way, I think it was 4 years ago, and we will do without PILT once again this biennium. So you will see at the very bottom, you'll see a total tax aids and credits, general fund total, and then I will subtract out PILT payments and give you a committee total. Why am I doing that if it's over in the Natural Resources Committee? Because the law says it's the Commissioner of Revenue that is responsible to pay for those payments. So the format of the program will be decided in Natural Resources, at least in the House, but the ultimate payment will come back to this spreadsheet at the very end. So, like I said, to make sure that we're aligned with committee totals, I will subtract out PILT from the bottom, and that will be something that will continue on.
Thank you. One moment, Ms. Schill. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Schill, could you provide us with a printout of payments to counties who have Indian casinos so we know what each county gets? In the form of the...
I can request that information.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much.
And there was one more thing. Yes, the spreadsheet. Every line on the spreadsheet, 33 accounts, I believe it is now, more detail is provided to you for whichever line that you might want to know in this catalog of budget activities. And so there's some general information how tax aids and credits relates to the overall budget. There's information on what a statutory direct or open appropriation is. Most every line for this committee is a forecasted appropriation. There are so it open as opposed to direct, which is way different than most of the other tax committees. But getting to page 10 is where we start with detail on each and every line that is on the spreadsheet. I give you 8 years of history. Well, it's not history. It's 3 years of actual expenditures, what's projected by this forecast, and then what the planning years are. So you have a snapshot of information from fiscal 10 to fiscal 17 for each and every line. And then there are some appendices. If you have any questions on this at all, please call me. It is available online under House Fiscal Analysis. And sorry, I took 12 minutes.
No, quite all right. Any last questions for Ms. Schill or any of the other presenters today? With that, to the lobbying and interest group public, the folks who are usually hanging in the back of the room chatting amongst themselves, if you wish to contact Ms. Jensen next week, we'll give people 2 or 3 minutes to introduce themselves so that everybody's got the same scorecard. They're working off of as to who's keeping an eye on us on any given day. With that, ladies and gentlemen, we are adjourned. Thank you very much.